All right, you may proceed.
May it please the court, my name is Jay O'Keefe, and I represent Gary Allen Ayers, the plaintiff below. I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal.
All right.
This is a nursing home case where the defendant admitted liability after dropping an 87-year-old resident nearly 3 feet to the floor, breaking 8 of her ribs and puncturing her spleen. The case presents 2 questions for the court's review. First, did the trial court abuse its discretion by denying a mistrial after the defendant told the jury that the federal government had paid all of the decedent's medical bills? The answer to that question is yes, under more than a century of case law. The defendant's question was both deliberate and incredibly prejudicial, particularly given that the only issue at trial was the quantum of damages. Second, was the trial court's error rendered harmless or waived by the plaintiff's own introduction of a medical record that contained inconsistent and ambiguous references to payment by Medicare and Medicaid? The answer to that question is no, but to understand our position on these 2 points, it's necessary to keep 3 facts in mind. First, the only issue at trial was damages. Second, before trial, the plaintiff moved to exclude all evidence of collateral source payments. The defendant didn't oppose that motion, and the trial court entered an agreed order. And third, at trial, the plaintiff called the nurse to discuss the decedent's physical condition upon entry to the nursing home. During that examination, the plaintiff introduced a medical record, the so-called MDS report. And the nurse explained that that's a report that gives a snapshot of a resident's physical condition upon admission. It's something they have to do for every patient, irrespective of that patient's funding source. And that seems to be a point of confusion in the briefs. So I direct the court to pages 52, 110, and 319 of the joint appendix for support for that.
Mr. O'Keefe, I know you didn't try this case. You may not actually know why certain things were done, but wouldn't it have been easy to redact any reference to a collateral source?
Yes, Your Honor. In hindsight, that probably should have been done. But for the reasons we'll explain, we do think those references were inconsistent and essentially innocuous when viewed in the context of the document and the trial as a whole.
Let me give you a potential reason why a plaintiff might want to do that. My initial thought was, why would a plaintiff ever want to do that? Because it appears that that is a collateral source. And that's what you're saying here. So why would it be done? Was it inadvertent? Was it just an oversight? Was it negligence on the part of the plaintiff's lawyer? Or does the revelation that these bills are being paid by Medicaid, bolster the question of whether or not these are necessary and reasonable? So that the plaintiff may very well have a reason why they wanted to have that reference in there. And if so, why aren't they stuck with it?
Your Honor, I don't know the actual answer to that question. And I don't think there's anything in the record to suggest that this was deliberate injection of the issue into the trial. But to get to the point of why aren't they stuck with it, you have the references in the document. One says that the current source of payment is Medicaid, and the other one says the resident hasn't been assigned a Medicaid number yet. Those are internally inconsistent, but assume that she is on Medicaid, like the defense says. It doesn't follow that the federal government or a combination of the federal or the state government are actually paying all of her medical bills, because the real world is a lot more complicated than this. And I can answer your question with an example that's outside the record. But in truth, my understanding is that Ms. Ayers was a Medicaid patient, but that meant that her actual medical bills were being paid by a combination of Medicare, Medicaid, private insurance, and out-of-pocket payments. So the fact that she is a Medicaid patient in the real world, which is complicated, doesn't necessarily license any of those inferences. So I suspect that it wasn't an attempt to show any reasonableness, because that doesn't necessarily follow from the fact that Medicaid's involved in the payment of her bills.
But once she opens the door by introducing this document, then they're allowed to ask questions on the same subject, are they not?
They are. The trial court specifically rejected the argument that they'd opened the door. And as to the same subject...
Where did the trial court specifically reject the notion?
That's JA 146, Your Honor. It's the colloquy right after the objection.
Well, the trial court offered to give a cautionary instruction, and that was rejected by the plaintiff.
That's correct, Your Honor.
So when you have a situation like this, you have either you ignore it altogether because you don't want to draw any attention to it. You get a cautionary instruction, and we presume that juries are going to follow the instruction, or you get a mistrial. But at this point in time, the cautionary instruction aspect of this is off the table because the plaintiff rejected it. So your case has to be that as a matter of law, this introduction of the test of the questions by defense counsel was a grounds for a mistrial as a matter of law.
That's correct, Your Honor, and we think we can make that showing under Lowe.
Go ahead.
The only issue at trial is damages, right? And Lowe tells us that when we're trying to gauge whether an improper question is so prejudicial it can't be fixed by a curative instruction, we look at three things: the relevance and content of the improper remark, whether it was deliberate or inadvertent, and the probable effect on the jury. So taking those in reverse order, the probable effect is devastating. It's going to gut the plaintiff's case because we're at a trial only on damages, and by far the largest element of damages is medical expenses. And with that one question, the defense both zeroes out that element and severely undermines the credibility of both the plaintiff and the plaintiff's counsel.
Don't we have to look at the probable effect using an abuse of discretion standard?
That's correct, Your Honor.
And in this instance, the judge, when you look at the transcript, the judge really seemed to have thought about what he should do and what would be the effect of each of the things that he would do. What Landrum prong did he violate?
Excuse me?
What Landrum prong did the judge violate? How did the judge abuse his discretion based upon the what's in the record about his thoughtful response?
His ultimate response boils down to a belief that when the parties finish messing with the jury's heads with their expert testimony, the jury's not going to remember this at all. And we think that is just a very...
Well, it was more than that. It was that it was a passing reference.
Right.
It was early in the trial. Yes, he said something. I mean, you've shaded it a bit, but he said several things. How did he abuse his discretion? Under the Landrum standard, where do we hang our hat?
He abused his discretion because the parties are here for one issue, that's damages. And the defense has highlighted this evidence that there were no medical expenses. And the judge, even given that the only issue the jury's here to consider is damages, looks at that and just says that in the course of a two-day trial, which is not a long trial, after we finished messing their heads with expert testimony, which didn't really, that's the medical testimony. It's not accountants talking about damages. The jury's not going to remember this at all. And we think that's just an unreasonable reading of the factual record. And we think that it's not a misunderstanding of the law so much as just a completely inappropriate application of that law to the facts.
Counsel, I don't see on 146 where the court says she didn't open the door, so I want to pursue that further. If she puts in this document, she has placed into issue Medicare or Medicaid or whichever is the potential funding source here. But beyond that, she reads from the document statements that would indicate that this document is used for the basis of payment of funds. With the document itself and the line of questioning that she goes into, tell me again why it is that the defense acted improperly in pursuing this.
Okay. Two points in response, Your Honor. The defendant's argument when the plaintiff objected was that the question was proper because the plaintiff had opened the door. And makes that argument on page 144. And then on pages 145 and 146, the court rejects that argument. And he says, now the question is, I'm not going to grant a mistrial, but I don't want any reference to Medicare or Medicaid.
I'm not saying she didn't open the door. The court may be saying the question was not egregious enough for me to grant a mistrial.
He's saying the question's not egregious enough to grant a mistrial, but if she had opened the door, it would be proper to explore Medicare and Medicaid. And he's saying that there is no exploration of Medicare or Medicaid.
If she had opened the door, it's proper to go this far and not beyond that. You may move on. I don't see the response there. Is that?
Well,
Counsel, the AFS responded by the opening the door comment on pages joint appendix 143 and 144. You might want to look there in terms of using your rebuttal time for that purpose.
Thanks, Your Honor. As to why the defense can't explore the question, 2 points on that. First, we all agree that the collateral source rule is both a rule of evidence and a rule of substantive law. And we both agree that we're only talking about the collateral source rule as a rule of evidence in this case. And both parties agree, and this is at page 14 of the defendant's brief, that the court could not have instructed the jury to consider collateral source payments. Once we accept those premises, it necessarily follows that there's no proper reason for asking these questions. The collateral source rule isn't a rule like hearsay that excludes otherwise relevant or probative evidence, that when you waive a hearsay objection or open the door, something comes in and there's a reason for the jury to consider it. The collateral source rule excludes evidence that is irrelevant and improper by definition, by virtue of being collateral source evidence. So once you accept the premises that the jury couldn't consider this or reduce its damages award because of it, and that we're only talking about the application of the evidentiary collateral source rule, then there's no reason to inject this stuff into the trial. We all agree that the jury couldn't consider it. That's one point. And the second point, I think, is that the defense's question went far beyond what's on the face of the document. And we agree that the jury's allowed to consider this document and had the plaintiff opened the door, and we don't think she did, the defense would be entitled to probe whatever she'd opened the door to whatever extent the judge thought was proper, and here it was to no extent. But the idea that a nursing home stay may have been funded in part by Medicaid in no way licenses the inference that all of the decedent's medical bills in that nursing home and beyond were paid for by the federal government. In fact, it doesn't even license the inference that all of the nursing home bills were paid for by the federal government, because Medicaid it's a joint state-federal program and the state fronts the pay. So the question is essentially a non sequitur. It doesn't follow from the document that was introduced. Your Honors, unless the court has any further questions, I'd like to reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
All right, you have 2 minutes and 23 seconds. You may proceed.
May it please the court, my name is Paul Connell, and I represent the appellee AFS of Hot Springs, Inc., and I must say I'm not sure that I necessarily recognize the attorney that appellant's counsel describes. This case was not a case only about damages. In fact, from the defense perspective, it was a case primarily about proximate cause. The defense position was that the decedent did fall as a result of the negligence of the nursing home, but that fall was not a proximate cause of the death. And that really was the most important question for the jury to answer, not so much damages, but whether this was a survival action versus a wrongful death action, and they correctly found, we believe, that it was a survival action. The appellant waived any objections to the evidence described by refusing the trial court's offer of a curative instruction. In terms of the timing of how things proceeded, a question was asked, a proper objection was raised, there was a colloquy between counsel and Judge Franklin in chambers, and it was plaintiff counsel who suggested that a curative instruction could possibly be given. Judge Franklin then offered to give a curative instruction, and then plaintiff counsel made a strategic decision. And I certainly don't criticize plaintiff counsel for doing this. I probably would have done the same thing. Plaintiff counsel refused the offer, saying, quote, "I think just leave it alone and move on." And that, if that's not a waiver, I'm not sure what is.
When was the motion for mistrial made?
The motion for mistrial, Your Honor, was made the next day. It wasn't quite 24 hours later, but it was made at the beginning of the second day of trial. The rule adopted by other states, in fact, we would argue the overwhelming weight of authority from other states and the federal circuits, we cite at least a dozen cases to this
effect.
Counsel,
if they're not arguing the failure to give a curative instruction, they're arguing the failure to grant the mistrial. Is your position that you have to ask for curative instruction before you can ask for a mistrial? Can you leapfrog the curative instruction?
We would argue that you can't leapfrog the curative instruction. That, in fact, the trial court judges who are there checking and the demeanor of the jurors are in the best position to determine whether a curative instruction is appropriate.
Are you saying that it's never appropriate to not ask for a curative instruction and simply ask for the mistrial? Could there be facts that are so egregious that no attorney would think that a curative instruction would possibly do any good, and so we just want a mistrial?
I have thought about that question, Your Honor, because I thought that might be asked. I suppose there are certain limited circumstances where the question could be per se prejudicial, such that no curative instruction could possibly correct it. An example might be a question that goes right to the core credibility of a party, for example, on cross-examination. If it came out that the plaintiff was formerly a Nazi concentration camp guard years ago, that question would be irrelevant and might just be so prejudicial that the court would say, look, a curative instruction can't cure that. I will go ahead and grant a mistrial. But if the court doesn't rule that circuit judges are required at least to attempt a curative instruction to cure the problem, then we're going to see a lot more mistrials.
Well, I think the case law is exactly the opposite nationwide. If you don't ask for the curative instruction in a timely manner, you've waived it. But he's not asking for one. He rejected it. And so the question here is whether or not asking for a mistrial the next day is too late. And the question, I think, appropriately to you would be, what is it that the trial court could have done the day before on the motion for mistrial that they can't do on the second day?
There's nothing that the court could have
done. See, the whole idea of making a temporaneous objection is so that the court can fix it. So what happened on the next day that was any different than the day before with regard to the mistrial? Now, it would have been clear with regard to the curative instruction, but with the mistrial, what's different?
There's nothing different, Your Honor, with respect to the mistrial motion, and we did not take issue with the plaintiff counsel's failure to preserve a request for a mistrial on day one, because Judge Franklin preempted that and said, even if you ask for it, I'm not going to give it to you. So we don't fault them for that, but you are correct. There is really nothing that had changed with respect to the motion for a mistrial, although we believe that Judge Franklin, who is in the best position to evaluate the jury, in his discretion felt that a mistrial was not warranted. And to that effect, we would cite the court to the Gonzales v. Largent opinion from the Intermediate Appellate Court in Florida, which is essentially our case, except for the fact that curative instruction was given. And the Florida Appellate Court is essentially saying that collateral source questions are not the kinds of questions that represent a manifest probability of prejudice. It can be corrected. We're only talking about one question. As Judge Franklin said, the jury probably was not even paying much attention at that point during the proceedings.
I'm under the impression the trial court did say that the plaintiff did not open the door, and you agree with that. The trial court said that.
The trial court felt that the door had not been opened.
All right, and then secondarily, there's no assignment of error, cross error from you that was error.
That's correct, Your Honor.
So it seems to me that question is not before us, is it?
It is not before the court. But
so maybe we need to focus on the other arguments that the appellant has as to why this question that was asked was proper, and it won't be because the door was open.
Well, it was a proper question, Your Honor, because I wanted to provide broader context for the jury in understanding the purpose behind that document. I didn't come up with an argument as elegant as Your Honor's at the time, but we felt that, or I felt at the time, that the jury needed to understand why this document is generated. It's not a document that is voluntarily generated by the
jury.
You didn't want to communicate to the jury that the federal government was paying the medical bills?
Well,
it just happens to be just kind of tertiary? It was mostly rhetorical.
Well, it seems like to me, I just wanted to make something clear. There's two different issues. One is whether or not the plaintiff opened the door. There's another question as to whether or not you might have perceived that the plaintiff opened the door, and that being a reason for your question. So I think a distinction needs to be made concerning that matter.
Well, the appellant made much in their brief regarding the deliberateness of the question, and I suppose the question...
Right, because that's what we're asking. Why would you have asked that question? If you thought the door was open, that would be a reason for you to ask that question.
I did believe the door was open. Okay. I believe in good faith that the door was open. And Judge Franklin also commented on Chambers that he did not believe that I was deliberately flouting a pretrial order of the court, that I believed in good faith, that by... publishing the document to the jury over 20 feet high in the Bath County courthouse and reading or asking my witness to read to the jury, I understand this information is used as a basis for ensuring that residents receive appropriate quality care and as a basis for payment of funds. To the best of my knowledge, this information was collected in accordance with applicable Medicare and Medicaid requirements. I felt that the door had been opened.
Well, Counsel, let me ask you a much less friendly question than Justice Goodwin asked you. How can asking somebody whether the federal government has paid all our bills been done for any reason other than to tell them that the federal government paid all the bills?
It was contrary to representations made by me in both opening statement and closing argument that we conceded $55,000 in medical bills in this case. So it was not an attempt to in any way erase in the jurors' minds the idea that someone paid for these bills even though the plaintiff is somehow claiming damages. And frankly, the jury verdict reflected that whether a curative instruction was given or not, the jury still got it right. Plaintiff does attempt to seek shelter under 801.384 with respect to the waiver of the curative instruction, and 384 has really no application here because it doesn't apply in situations where there is an affirmative waiver, and as I stated earlier, counsel expressly stating, quote, I think just leave it alone and move on. Has got to be considered to be an express waiver. Contrary to appellant's argument, this plaintiff counsel wasn't placed in a catch-22 by Judge Franklin with respect to whether to ask for a curative instruction, possibly highlight the improper evidence again. We have to recognize that the trials are imperfect, and litigants are only entitled to fair trials. They're not entitled to perfect trials, and you have to give the trial court the opportunity to correct the error at the time when it arose. And even if the issue was not waived, the mistrial argument raised by the appellant fails on the merits. As Your Honor said, if they had not wanted these issues to be explored, the document could have been redacted. I still to this day do not know why plaintiff counsel asked our witness to read into evidence a statement regarding Medicare and Medicaid. And we believe that even if the plaintiff had asked for a curative instruction, it could have easily been fixed. Jurors are presumed to follow the instructions of the court, and mistrials are only appropriate where the prejudicial effect is so overwhelming, such as in the case of asking questions that go to a litigant's credibility. You're a felon, aren't you? You have been convicted of a certain heinous crime. The rule in other jurisdictions is that improper evidence of collateral source, however it comes in, is not fatal. It can be cured. And then finally, any error in this case was harmless because the plaintiff introduced the evidence establishing the same fact as the allegedly improper statement. The rule is that admission of improper evidence is harmless where plaintiff introduced or opposing party introduced the evidence in their case in chief. And the evidence from the MDS sheet was such that it was not a stretch for the jurors to have concluded on their own that the bills were being paid by Medicare and Medicaid, and so we would contend.
So your argument there is that that the plaintiff themselves actually waived the benefit of the collateral source rule, and that evidence, having been presented, may be considered by the jury. Consequently, any reduction in the verdict, which was based on the plaintiff's evidence, and not your question, but the plaintiff's evidence, is harmless error.
That's correct, Your Honor. If there are no further questions, I will subside.
All right. Mr. O'Keefe, you have 2 minutes and 23 seconds.
Thank you, Your Honor. On the question of whether the trial court found that the plaintiff had opened the door, the best site I can give the court is pages 144 to 146. And at page 144 to the top of 145, Ms. Ellerman says, the document doesn't mean my client was receiving care by Medicare or Medicaid. In fact, I believe Ms. Plumlee said every single nursing home patient has the document. The court said she did say that. The argument goes on, and then the court says on 146 he's not going to grant a mistrial, and he doesn't want any further reference to Medicare or Medicaid. In the context of the colloquy, I think that's a rejection of the argument that the plaintiff had opened the door. Second, the only issue in the case was damages. I mean, the jury was instructed that the defendant was negligent. Negligence is duty, breach, causation, damages. The question of proximate cause comes up only in terms of determining what quantum of damages the plaintiff gets. Third, Gonzalez and those extra jurisdictional cases that the defendant is relying on are factually distinguishable because they're not in cases where the only issue is damages. There's not, on my reading of the cases, a blanket rule that a curative instruction always fixes a collateral source payment issue. I think it's a factually dependent inquiry, and the unique facts of this case mean that a curative instruction wouldn't have been good enough. Fourth, as to the defense argument that you can't leapfrog the curative instruction and you have to ask for both a curative instruction and a mistrial, that will fly in the face of decades of this court's case law and the Reed versus Baumgartner line of cases that say you ask for a curative instruction or a mistrial. And so I guess we'd have to overrule those. On the question of good faith, I don't doubt for a second that my colleague was acting in good faith. But the test under Lowe is deliberateness versus inadvertence. It's a mistake. It's not bad faith. And the question was plainly deliberate. There were three foundational questions leading up to it. And then the blanket question, because Ms. Ayers, all of her medical bills were being paid for by the federal government. That's not a situation where a witness blurted something out that was non-responsive. That was clearly a deliberate question, and that's what the case law looks to.
Well, if the plaintiff in a motion in limine requests the benefit of the collateral source rule, and we determine that what the plaintiff did actually violated the collateral source rule, what do you say about his argument that, well, the jury had the right to listen to the plaintiff's own evidence? So any error, if it was error at all, has to be harmless because they could have based their verdict on the plaintiff's evidence.
And to clarify your question, Your Honor, are you asking that as a Pettis versus Gottfried Drinker Knuckles argument, or are you asking it just as a straight harmless error argument?
Well, his was, I think, a pretty much straight harmless error argument, so you respond to his argument.
Harmless error, okay. First, errors are presumptively harmful unless the record affirmatively shows that they couldn't have affected the outcome of the case. Second, the information in the MDS report was limited both to payment for the nursing home stay, and it was internally ambiguous about who's paying for that. That is a world removed from the federal government is paying all medical bills, nursing home and otherwise. And then third, even if you accept the defendant's reading of the MDS report, which is a medical record prepared by a nurse, it's not anything prepared by a billing department, but if you accept that as unequivocal evidence that Medicaid was the payer, it still doesn't follow that the other medical expenses from other hospitals are being paid for by the federal government. Again, the way these things work in real life are much, much more complicated, and you get the injection of additional insurance on top of that, additional payment out of pocket, and where does Medicaid start and Medicare begin? And so for those reasons, Your Honor, we don't think that the introduction of that document rendered the defense's question harmless error.
All right. Thank you very much. Call the next case.